You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of December on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's program.
The images are absolutely gut-wrenching. Young children carried away in ambulances, a teacher burned alive in front of the students, a house of learning turned into a house of unspeakable horror.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry speaking of today's Taliban attack on a school in Pakistan that left at least 141 people dead. How should the world and the world's media react? Plus, as Russia reels from a falling ruble, can Putin stay popular? Just some of the questions on the agenda in the next 30 minutes as journalist Tim Marshall and political historian Dr. James Boyes join me to give their perspectives. Coming up later in the program, we'll review a selection of the Brazilian Weekly Press with Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and we'll hear from Jay-Z DJ Young Guru.
Anybody can grab a laptop and become sort of a DJ, and DJs today nowadays are sort of like the celebrity of the DJ is almost as big as the skill. When I was coming up, it was absolutely all about skill.
That's in our music review a little later in today's program. So lots coming up here as usual on Midori House on Monocle 24. But ahead of all that, James Luckhurst is here with the headlines.
Monocle 24 News. At least 141 students and 9 staff members have been killed after Taliban gunmen broke into a school in the Pakistani city of Peshawar and opened fire. The attack is the bloodiest massacre the country has seen for years. More than 8 hours after militants slipped into the heavily guarded compound through a back entrance, the army declared the operation to flush them out over and said that all 9 insurgents had been killed. Correspondents say the attack on the army-run high school struck at the heart of Pakistan's military establishment, an assault certain to enrage the country's powerful generals. Rupert Colville of the United Nations Human Rights Agency condemned the attack.
But when children are deliberately targeted in this way, it goes to another level. And really the Taliban today have hit a level of barbarity that is hard to recall, that anyone has attacked children in this way, apparently deliberately trying to kill as many as they could before they were killed themselves.
The US Secretary of State John Kerry was quick to pledge assistance to Pakistan.
This act of terror angers and shakes all people of conscience, and we condemn it in the strongest terms possible. The perpetrators must be brought to justice. And we pledge our full support to the people of Pakistan in this difficult hour, and we will help them in any way that we possibly can.
At least 25 people, among them 15 children, have been killed in twin car bomb attacks in the central Yemeni province of Baidar. The children were inside a school bus that was passing a checkpoint manned by Shia Houthi rebels in the Radar area when the first bomb exploded. The second one went off soon afterwards near a home of a Houthi leader. The rebels blamed Sunni jihadist militants from Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula for the blasts. They've been fighting in Radar since the Houthis overran the Al-Qaeda stronghold in October, a month after taking control of the capital Sana'a. The Russian ruble is continuing to make dramatic losses against the dollar and euro despite the central bank raising interest rates by 6.5% overnight to 17%. In afternoon trading in Moscow, the currency weakened beyond 80 rubles per dollar and 100 rubles per euro for the first time. Christian Schultz is an investment economist at Berenberg Bank. He said the end game for Russia would be political rather than financial.
It seems that the only thing that really can stop this decline in the short run is some signs that Russia will do things that would ease the pressure of sanctions. Only if Russia makes political steps to ease that pressure, for instance, by agreeing to a more permanent ceasefire in Ukraine and stopping maybe or at least not increasing the support to the separatists there, do I see a chance that Russia will get out of this.
The Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott has visited the scene of the Sydney siege, hours after it was brought to an end by commandos. They stormed the cafe in Martin Place after shots were fired inside. Jeb Bush, brother to former US President George W. Bush, has announced he himself is looking into running for president in 2016. The former Florida governor wrote on Facebook that he would actively explore the possibility of running for president. Mr. Bush is not the only familiar name circling the upcoming election. Former First Lady and US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is currently the front-runner for the 2016 Democratic ticket. The Romanian Prime Minister Victor Ponta says he's handed back his doctorate 2 years after he was first accused of plagiarising chunks of his law thesis. While he still denies plagiarism, Ponta's move shows he's keen to end damaging speculation about his PhD as he tries to rebuild confidence in his government weeks after losing a presidential election. And that's the latest news here at Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette é Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 18:06 here in London, 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, I have Tim Marshall, diplomatic editor of Sky News, and Dr. James Boyes, historian and author, most recently of Clinton's Grand Strategy. Welcome both. We will start tonight in Pakistan, which is today counting the cost of what is far from the first large-scale massacre perpetrated by Pakistan's Taliban, and only the latest in their long campaign of attacks on schools. But even by their standards, today's assault on the army public school in Peshawar is an act of singular ruthlessness. At least 141 people, mostly children, have been killed. 9 gunmen also reported dead. Tim, I want to ask you first. Obviously, this is a imagination beggaring crime. But from the Pakistani Taliban's point of view, they've said that it's a gesture of revenge, that just as Pakistan's army have killed their children, so they will kill the children of Pakistan's soldiers. But that aside, is it possible they perceive any strategic purpose to this? Because this isn't it's not a spontaneous reaction. They have decided to sacrifice 9 of their men carrying out this attack. For what? Where are they going with this? Is that possible to tell?
An end to the offensive against them, which started in June. Zab-e-Azb is the operation's name. It's been going on for 5 months now. They've taken massive losses up in North Waziristan, and this is their response. Okay, if you're going to come after us, we're going to come after you. It was the Americans who pushed the Pakistani military in the first place several years ago. You've got to get up and get at the Taliban, because it was this hammer and chisel approach in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, coming at them from both sides. You squeeze the Taliban and you smash them against the Pakistan and the American forces. It hasn't worked, but the Americans have continued the pressure. You must go and smash them. We just heard from Kerry, we're going to go after them still. And the Americans still want the Pakistanis, but this is the response to it. I mean, it is, as far as I can remember, the most despicable act that they've carried out so far, and their list is very long. But they're saying to the Pakistani military, back off, let's go back to the old days. We run this area, you don't.
James, though, this, it seems extremely unlikely to me to bring about any sort of de-escalation from the Pakistani army. I mean, bursting into a school and killing scores of the Pakistani army's children is not really likely to calm anybody down, is it?
Absolutely not. You know, one wonders where on earth this is going to lead to. I mean, Tim and I were talking before we came on air about, you know, various practices that have been taking place in that part of the world and various initiatives that have led to try to do something about it and the people involved. And, you know, at least back in the first term of Barack Obama's administration, we had someone like Richard Holbrooke, who was very much an emissary to what he referred to as the AFPAC region, trying to very much recognise that there is direct linkage there. I think part of the problem now is that John Kerry is flying around the world, you know, focusing on this, focusing on that, desperately seeking his elusive Nobel Peace Prize. But the problem is, A, his time is running out, and B, he's only got so much he can focus upon. And I think that US foreign policy is so stretched at this point, it's very difficult to leverage anything in that part of the world. And as you rightly point out, you know, this tit-for-tat retaliation is only going to carry on and be fueled by today's events.
James is absolutely right to put it in the context of Afghanistan and Pakistan. I mean, it's the US draw. This is the year of the drawdown of US troops, and the Taliban operate on both sides of that border. And the fewer American troops there are, the more they can operate with impunity in Afghanistan and reinforce and crisscross. So I'm afraid that this is not a great watershed. This is not the beginning of something new. This is not the end. This is part of a very long, bloody process, at the end of which either the Americans lose concentration and stop putting pressure on the Pakistani government, and it goes back to the de facto position, which is that on the northwest frontier, in those provinces, they do take their hands off and the government control off, and those people do run the area. I mean, it might be very unpalatable, especially when you've seen the behaviour of today, but that might be the end game.
But this has, I mean, this has been the case not just for the last few years, but for decades, yeah. Nay, centuries. The northwest frontier province of Pakistan is not, it's not really a terrifically governable territory. I mean, I was in Peshawar in 1998 when things were really, in many respects, much calmer than they are now, but I couldn't leave the city limits without an armed escort, and that was in 1998.
And that's you with respect. If you, I mean, even if Bill Clinton, when he flew into, I think it was Islamabad, I think, during the last year of his presidency, the Secret Service refused to allow him to fly in on Air Force One because it was such an easily identifiable aircraft, and they made him fly in an unmarked jet, and that was, what, 15 years ago. So you're absolutely right, this is not anything new, and as Tim rightly points out, this isn't the beginning nor the end of a series of atrocities, it's just the latest in an escalating series, I think.
You can take a moral high ground as you like about the despicable act and the way they're behaving, but you know they're not in that game of morality. They don't play in that territory. They play in the game of pure power, and we've seen their pure power today. You're absolutely right. The Pakistani army is not going to take this lying down. They're going to go back in all guns blazing. And so it's going to go on until one side or the other. They either smash the Taliban, which for me they look unbreakable, or after a few years, they withdraw. They pretend they're in charge of the whole of Pakistan, but in fact they're only in charge of most of it.
Which is the way it used to be. There was that strange gentleman's agreement up until really September 11th, whereby it was generally held that as long as you stayed on the Khyber Pass road,
exactly.
you'd be left alone.
The Talibs broke the agreement by going so much further, including into the valleys, coming up to Islamabad, the capital. And at that point, the Pakistanis said, hang on a minute, that's far too close. You don't come that close to us. And under American pressure, they pushed back. They tried to make it this hammer and anvil. What happened was the anvil turned into a sponge and just soaked them up. They disappear, they come back.
And the interesting thing here is, of course, we're talking about the Taliban in Pakistan, and we're not mentioning necessarily Afghanistan, where, of course, you know, Allied forces went in now so many years ago to try to basically remove their power base. I think what this act does is just exacerbates this idea that after, 14, 15 years worth of investment of blood and treasure, you know, what are we going to have to show for all that sacrifice in Afghanistan when the Taliban can act pretty much with impunity, not only in Pakistan, but across the border. So you've got a new administration in Afghanistan that people are saying, well, this could be a start of something. But to what extent are they really just governing Kabul? And, you know, how much control are they really going to have ever over the countryside once the US and the British finally ultimately pull out? And, you know, where's that going to head?
Staying with you on that subject, James, because American foreign policy being your specialist sure. subject, John Kerry has, of course, today made all the right noises, blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah, happy to help, willing to help, etc., etc., etc. Is there anything America can do in this situation that isn't going to make it even worse than it already is?
It's difficult to identify a series of policies that the administration can really enact at this point. And one of the reasons for that actually has less to do with American leverage overseas and a lot to do with the American domestic electoral timescale, because as your report at the top of the hour said, we're already looking at 2016 and all eyes turn to guess what? A Bush candidacy and a Clinton presidency. But the way in which that situation is set up so that every 2 years your eyes turn ahead. What that means is it's very difficult to leverage out and invest in a long-term grand strategy. And it's obviously the area I've been doing some work on with my book, but not wanting to plug that too much. or maybe I will. This idea that it's difficult to see how Obama's going to put anything in place that's going to be in place in less than 18 months' time is difficult because he'll be replaced. And the Taliban, as Tim was alluding to earlier on, all they've got to do is play the long game. They know the Americans will leave and then again can move back into that void that the Americans leave. And then where are we at? We're at where we were 15 years ago, at the very least.
Well, on that happy note, we will move from one intractable conflict to another. EU foreign ministers yesterday agreed to back a UN peace plan for a truce in Aleppo, which before the Syrian conflict began was the country's largest city and its commercial epicentre. The plan calls for a freeze in the fighting to enable the delivery of humanitarian assistance. Tim, seriously, is anything likely to come of this?
No.
Move on.
We could. No, I mean, obviously, it's an awful situation. There's a number of reasons why it won't happen. I mean, look, let's hope the best they can go for is something like an afternoon of ceasefire to get some stuff in and just to help some people. But as a long-term ceasefire, no. And there's a number of reasons for that. First and foremost is that the Assad government forces are looked to be on the verge of surrounding the city, at which point they've cut off all the rebel fighters inside.
Who were busy. They recaptured quite a lot of territory north of Aleppo late last week.
Yes. And Idlib, though, I mean, it's back and forth, but they are now surrounding, the government forces are surrounding Aleppo. They are hardly likely at this point to agree to a ceasefire. The other two elements about why it probably won't happen is that the Syrian government is saying to the rebel forces, as part of the any truce, you've got to hand over your heavy weapons. Absolutely no chance whatsoever. And the rebels are saying, and the government forces, if there's a ceasefire, cannot move anywhere, so they can't manoeuvre themselves around. It's just not going to happen. They are in the midst of the death struggle still, as they have been for a couple of years. This has got months minimum still to run. As I said, the best they can hope, get some sort of day ceasefire, get as much help in as possible, get as many people out as they can, and just try and work with what you've got. And when the EU says, oh, we're doing this or doing that, at a political level, it's nowhere. A much bigger event is going on, much more under the radar, and that's that the Russians are going to try and put together a Geneva-type conference, but this time in Moscow. The Americans and the Europeans have tried and failed, and it's not their fault. It's the Syrians, up to an extent, fault. The Russians under the radar now are moving. They're going to try for a Geneva-type conference, but in Moscow. They say they're talking to the rebels. Let's see if it happens.
James, Federica Mogherini, the new EU foreign policy chief, I suspect possibly trying to make some sort of early impact here. She says the EU is still, I think I've written this down right, because it makes no sense whatsoever. She says the EU is still trying to bring about a Syria without Assad and without ISIS, which is it's a nice idea. Do you perceive any kind of plan here for how that's actually going to happen?
You know what? It's hysterical, isn't it? We're sitting here talking about this. What are we talking about here? We're talking about people sitting in an office somewhere in the EU talking about how they can try and influence change in Syria when nobody else has managed to do so.
For three years they've been saying no Assad.
And how are they going to leverage that? Do you think anybody in the Assad regime is now thinking, oh my goodness, Cassie Ashton's replacement is now saying we've got to play ball. We better do something about it. I sincerely doubt it.
You know, it's time to think the unthinkable, that maybe he has to stay.
Yeah. And the way that policy has been heading recently, you can see how that is going to happen, irrespective of what anybody really, really wants. Because unfortunately, if you don't accept that, then you've got to leverage him out. And at this point, no one is prepared to invest time, money, and effort to do so.
Well, this is where the thought occurs to me that this another reason why this idea seems quite odd, in that this does give up. This gives Assad a path to the moral high ground, does it not? He can wait for the opposition to reject the whole thing, and then he can say, well, I was willing to give it a go, but you see what I'm having to deal with here. Well,
that's been a ploy from the beginning, and he's very cleverly, once Islamic State began to show their true face, he was able to say, oh, well, you know, this is what we're up against. I'm on the same side as you guys against terrorism. I mean, nobody buys it. Nobody buys that he's a good guy. It's just that finally, and it took nearly 3 years, people buy the idea that there's two bad guys.
Well, on that happy thought, we will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Tim Marshall and James Boyce. When we return, we will be discussing Putin and popularity and how long he can hang on to it, and the eternally vexed question of gun control in the United States.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, coming up for 20 past 1800 here in London. Still with me are Tim Marshall and Dr. James Boyes. Now, last night, Russia's central bank took dramatic action to rescue the country's plummeting currency, hiking its base interest rate from an already eye-catching 10.5% to an eye-watering 17%. Today, they will have been wondering where one goes after panic stations. The ruble has continued its journey downwards, hitting record lows against the dollar, at one stage dipping more than 20% in a day. The Russian stock market has also dipped nearly 25% this week. James, does this look reversible to you?
Well, you know, it's very easy to say, oh, you know, this is horrendous, it's a turning point, yada, yada, yada. I think history is replete with turning points, and the media, excuse me for want of a better expression, are prone to wanting to focus on crises. This isn't good for Putin, it's not great for Russians, but they've been through a lot worse. I mean, I think everybody sitting around this table can remember when there were interest rates in this country of, you know, comparable, back in the good old days.
higher,
absolutely.
Indeed, yeah.
So I think if we can survive it, the Ruskies can, quite frankly. It's clearly putting some pressure on Putin, but it's not going to be enough. You know, there's a whole range of issues that Vladimir Putin is facing at this point. But I think that the way he's reacted and the way he's played, you know, I keep saying on this station, he's playing a blinder, he's doing this and the other. You know, what he will do, I'm quite sure, is to basically, you know, round the wagons and say, look, you know, we've got to unite, it's us against them, effectively. And he will use this to draw strength from the opposition he's facing from overseas. He'll talk about, you know, Russian nationalism to a certain extent. He'll say this is, you know, justifying his stance, effectively. I mean, ultimately, you know, I heard a thing today saying he's got an approval rating of like 80% something. Well, it's hardly surprising when you consider that there is no great opposition, effectively. But, you know, until the West can really make it bite, he's going to keep doing what he's doing because it's in his and in Russia's national interest to do so, arguably, I think.
Putin is indeed making all those noises, blaming the West, blaming speculators, etc., etc. Tim, how long can he rely on the Russian people buying that?
Well, he's got until 2024 under the new constitution that he managed to redraw. I doubt he's got that long, but he's not rocking yet. You know, no one's about to push him over, so he's got the near to middle future. I didn't know that James said he'd been playing a blinder. That's an expression I use as well. I've argued for the last couple of years that Putin's been playing a blinder, and I get into fierce arguments with British diplomats who insist to me that no, the Western diplomats are running rings around him, and that the sanctions are biting. And yes, they are biting, and we've seen the proof today. But when was the Russian economy ever in a really good shape? Never.
A fair point. It defaulted
and
as recently as 1998.
They've got $650 billion in foreign reserves. This year, they've spent around about $50 billion. That gives them another 12 years of spending all their foreign reserves. And within that 12 years, the oil price will bounce back from $60. I mean, I think it's going to be pretty low for some considerable time, and that's what's really killing them, not the sanctions, the oil price. And their budget for next year was set, when they did it this year, at $114 a barrel. Now they're actually only going to get between 90 and 60, so they've got a massive hole, and they'll fill it from their reserves, and they can do that for several years to come. And that's why they're not about to collapse. I mean, aren't you remember Black Friday here, or Black Monday, or Dodgy Tuesday, or whichever day it is? You know, the world suddenly come to an end. Dubai is about to fall flat on its face. I mean, and then you realise that the world goes on. Russia is hurting really badly, don't get me wrong, but I don't see that Putin is about to be pushed over.
And I think one of the main reasons for that, following directly upon that, is where else are the oligarchs effectively going to go, effectively? You know, he is very much playing the game that they want him to play, I think, to an extent. You know, he's got an assertive foreign policy. You know, we were talking earlier on about issues to do with Ukraine, for example, and the rationale for that. He's been playing a blinder for the last 18 months. So when I see Time magazine come out and talk about its man of the year being the Ebola fighters, it's absolute nonsense. The man of the year for the last 2 years, in terms of who has driven policy, who has driven the global agenda, has been, like it or not, Vladimir Putin.
Well, finally tonight, we will take a look at America, where after yet another mass shooting, there is yet another debate about the wisdom of the country's relaxed attitude to gun ownership, almost as if the two phenomena are somehow related. Police in Pennsylvania are currently searching for Bradley William Stone, an Iraq war veteran believed to have shot dead his ex-wife and five members of her family. Tim, This is a question that's been asked many times, not least nearly just over 2 years ago now after the Sandy Hook massacre. Is it actually possible to imagine the gun-related events so bad that America does actually think, really, what are we doing?
I can imagine a pretty unpleasant scenario involving lots and lots of people in a militia, but I doubt it. How bad does it have to get? And we always approach this from here, a British point of view, in the European point of view, where it happens much less and people don't have the right to bear arms. That's because we have a different history and a different approach to life. We think differently. Now, obviously, there's massive amounts of Americans that do want gun control, but there's massive amounts of Americans that don't want gun control, and it does go back to the Second Amendment, which James knows off by heart. a well-regulated militia. The reason you can have a well-regulated militia is because the government might not be very nice. Now, I don't think they meant that you can therefore buy a Kalashnikov, but that's where it springs from, and they will give up that freedom to defend yourself. They won't give it up easily. And then you get into the politics and the pork barrel politics of it and the fact that the National Rifle Association is so powerful that individual ordinary voices get drowned out in the politics of it all. Nothing's going to change.
I always remember as well that the Second Amendment was, of course, written at a time when it took you all afternoon to load a rifle to fire one shot.
That helped.
Let me address your question directly, because in terms of what event could trigger this, could anything happen so bad? Well, we've seen American presidents been assassinated, candidates for presidency been assassinated, schools been shot up, military bases been shot up, standoffs with militia groups. None of these have triggered anything even remotely close to a national debate about gun control ownership.
There's been a debate, James. It's just that after 2.5 days, you move on and the debate's over. Yeah,
and until the next time it happens, which it always does. The other angle that will be scrutinised here is that Bradley William Stone, the presumed shooter, is a former Marine. He's an Iraq war veteran. 20% of US suicides are veterans. 21% of domestic abuse is committed by veterans. James, are we doing enough, or not just the United States, but the Western world in general, to look after the heads, I guess, of people when they come back?
Clearly we're not. I mean, it's as simple as that. You look at how much is spent upon frontline troops and forces, and to be quite honest, I mean, even the people on the front line say, you know, that they don't have enough in terms of equipment, and we've heard stories over the last 10, 15 years of people having to supplement their own kit. So quite clearly, enough isn't being spent on either frontline or in support mechanisms. But to return to the initial point about this story, you know, I'm lucky I get to deal with an awful lot of American students, and even the most liberal, East Coast individuals who you would think from a European latte drinking Guardian readership position would be adamant that they don't want guns are sitting there going, hang about, I'm an American, it's my right to own a gun, and the only people who will surrender their guns under an amnesty of any sort will be the law-abiding citizens, and it will leave the criminals as armed to the teeth, and we, the American citizens, will be lacking in any way of defending ourselves.
I think it's more, I think the second point you came up with about the treatment of people who may have PST after Iraq and Afghanistan is not being addressed. And I think it's more likely that we get some traction on that debate, and that not enough is being done. People have got this template of the Second World War and people having shell shock and then coming home and building the new society. They don't have a template of what people went through in the types of wars of Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a personal view. I think that the first Vietnam film was Taxi Driver. There's a passing reference to Travis Bickle, the taxi driver. There's a passing reference that he was in the Marines and he was in NAM. And then he goes off and goes completely bonkers and kills people. It's just a passing reference. But that was the first sign that America was beginning to understand the Vietnam legacy. I don't think, even with a couple of the films there have been, I don't think that America has yet had its proper debate. I mean, the Brits, for example, 6,000 were injured. 6,000 in Afghanistan. There was 563 deaths, but 6,000 injuries. I don't think people understand the scale of that and what it does to people's heads. And it's a debate which is overdue. I mean, it's not quite as serious a debate as about gun control and the scale of the loss of life, but it is a debate that needs to be heard.
Just final thought from you, James, on this, and a reasonably brief one if possible.
Sure.
America seems to me to react differently to veterans depending on which war they've come back from. How do you think over the next, 5 to 10 years, veterans of Afghanistan and Iraq will be regarded? Because you can just about call them a draw at best, really.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of it has to do with how the wars are perceived and portrayed. Don't forget, in the aftermath of Vietnam, they were dealt very poorly. As Tim alluded to, because in part, because the response of Hollywood to try to redress that war, you know, Rambo, you know, we're going to get to win this time sort of mentality. You know, you can retell history. History is not dead. You can retell it. I think it's far too soon with regard to Iraq and Afghanistan to know how history will tell those stories.
James Boyes, also Tim Marshall, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's loads still coming up in the second half of today's show, including a leaf through the Brazilian news weeklies and a chat with Jay-Z's DJ, no less. But before all that, James Luckhurst is here with the headlines.
At least 132 students and 9 staff members have been killed after Taliban gunmen broke into a school in the Pakistani city of Peshawar and opened fire. The attack is the bloodiest massacre in the country for years. More than 8 hours after militants slipped into the heavily guarded compound through a back entrance, the army declared the operation to flush them out over and said that all 9 insurgents had been killed. At least 25 people, among them 15 children, have been killed in a twin car bomb attack in the central Yemeni province of Baida. The children were inside a school bus that was passing a checkpoint manned by Shia Houthi rebels in the Radar area when the first bomb exploded. The second one went off soon afterwards near the home of a Houthi leader. The Russian ruble has continued to make dramatic losses against the dollar and euro, despite the central bank raising interest rates by 6.5% overnight to 17%. In afternoon trading in Moscow, the currency weakened beyond 80 rubles per dollar and 100 rubles per euro for the first time. Jeb Bush, a brother to former US President George W. Bush, has announced he himself is looking into running for president in 2016. The former Florida governor wrote on Facebook that he would actively explore the possibility of running for president. And authorities in the US are searching for an Iraq war veteran who's suspected of killing 6 members of the same family in towns around Philadelphia. Police in the area have urged residents to stay indoors. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life. A benchmark for style.
Welcome back to Midori House, live on Monocle 24, 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, 16:33 in Rio de Janeiro. Time now for us to take a look at the news weeklies of a particular country or particular magazine market. Today it's Brazil, and joining me in the studio is Monocle's resident Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and unfortunately on radio we cannot do justice to his trousers. First of all, Fernando, Istoé. Which I've been practicing my pronunciation.
Which means this is.
Okay.
Which means isto é, this is.
It's okay.
a very good, you know, weekly magazine. And this week, it's a very interesting story saying why Brazilians prefer to travel abroad. You might say, oh, they might want to enjoy new cultures or, you know, something else. Or
fair guess.
Not really. They actually, it's cheaper. You know, it's cheaper for a Brazilian to go to cities, even cities that are considered expensive, like Paris or London, than traveling their own country. And they did a big research. For example, do you know that if you spend 7 nights in New York, it's more expensive, including the flight tickets, than if you spend... Sorry, it's cheaper than if you spend seven nights in a beach in the northeast of Brazil. The prices are really high.
New York is not a cheap city either. Why is Brazil such an expensive place to travel in?
Well, because, you know, first of all, we do have high taxes. And I do think the aviation, we don't have enough seats in a way. So, you know, we don't have so much competition. So, of course, the airlines that we have, they can raise the price as much as they want. And that's the main complaint, and actually, you know. So, and that's why Brazilians spend so much abroad, you know. I would say, I think we are the second nationality that spends the most in the US. So I think even the salespeople of luxury stores, if they know you're a Brazilian, they're going to treat you a little bit better, actually.
Is there any suggestion in Istoe's story that the government is trying to... alter that, because obviously that is a massive drain on the country if people are just fleeing in their droves and spending all their money somewhere else.
It's funny because, you know, there's a lot of cases in the magazine, like for you know, but they don't really offer some sort of solution. For example, there's a lot of interesting human interest stories, like a group of three guys, they wanted to spend, you know, New Year's in Rio, but they decided to rent a beautiful big house in Montevideo because that was cheaper to stay in a hostel. I mean hostel, not a hotel in Rio, because, I mean, if you want to stay in a five-star hotel in Rio de Janeiro, God, it's better if you go to the Ritz in Paris.
Well, moving along to the story I was certainly most excited about discussing, this is Veia Sao Paulo, who have on their cover what can only be described as a priest dressed as Elvis Presley.
Exactly, and he's buff as well, because he goes to the gym four times a week. And his name, well...
And on the seventh day, he rests.
Exactly. Or maybe he doesn't, because actually, you know, I've seen a video of his mass. You know, I didn't have the chance, the pleasure to see one of his masses. He doesn't stop dancing and singing, and he's the new sensation. Basically,
This was the plot of an episode of Father Ted, you do realise, pretty much. But, no, but he's a big thing. His name is Padre Marcelo Rossi. It says here he sold more than 14 million albums.
Well, actually, that's the first one. He started the trend.
There's a whole bunch of priests dressed as Elvis? Fantastic.
But the new one, the one that's on the cover, actually, his name is Marcos Roberto Pires. And he didn't release an album, but there is an expectation. I think he's going to release an album next week. And always his masses, there's like 1,000. You know, the church that he attends is at Butantã, and there's only 600 seats, but usually there's 1,000 people, a lot of people waiting outside, and, you know, he's on TV and everything. But you mentioned Padre Marcelo Rossi. He was the first one who started this trend back in 98.
Does he dress like Elvis or not dress like Elvis?
He doesn't dress like Elvis, but, you know,
that's a shame.
He's very handsome. He used to be a surfer. You know, actually, I think I even bought his first album.
Okay.
I have to tell you that, you know.
Because it strikes me that there is a way here that Brazil could do something to get back some of those lost tourist revenues. This should be the poster that they advertise overseas. It's like, come to Brazil, our priests look like Elvis.
Exactly, and they dance, they shake it, you know, the country of carnival. You know, if you want to do God, you have to do God while you're dancing and singing.
Fantastic. No, I look forward to his I mean, he's clearly going to make a record. He's holding a microphone here.
And, you know, the songs are good. You know, think about gospel, you know, and, you know, and add some Brazilian bits, and then you get, you know.
We have a slightly drier selection, finally. This is Exame.
So, yeah, it's not all about rock and roll priests.
That's,
you know,
a shame.
It's a shame, indeed. You know, that's Exame, which is our business weekly in Brazil. It's some sort of our version of Bloomberg Business Week. As I said, it's very dry, a bit boring, but, you know, it's a very important magazine. It sells very well. And I think if you're in the business sector, you know, you would read Exame. You know, it's a very important magazine in the Brazilian market. And this week, you know, they have a very positive cover, actually, saying that the country, Brazil, is leaving the shadows, because they're showing a study that in the last 10 years, Brazil managed to reduce the withholding of taxes, which used to be one of our major problems. And they're saying that this is happening at the same time of the, you know, we're having a huge corruption scandal being investigated at the moment at our national oil company. But they're saying it's not all bad, actually. Brazil did improve in the last 10 years. And, you know, because the way we're talking sometimes about the Petrobras scandal, that is the end of the world, but it's not really. At least things are being investigated.
It's kind of a brave cover. It does look at first glance quite gloomy, trying to describe it here. There's a sort of like grim blue night sky and a lot of very dark buildings and silhouetted figures, but the idea is that the lights pouring out of the buildings are supposed to be the key signifier.
Maybe they're playing with their audience as well, which is, you know, like a businessman who don't want to see a smile on the cover or something like that.
I mean, is there a general perception, I guess, both among Brazilians in general and the business community that the country is becoming, I guess, more transparent and slightly less, well, slightly less how it used to be, to put it tactfully.
I think most Brazilians, and you know, that's actually one of the things that I think helped Dilma Rousseff to be reelected, because at the same time, there's been so much corruption revealed to Brazilians and everybody's fed up. But people are saying, well, at least we know what's happening, you know, because people, we know that corruption exists in Brazil, you know, since we started when the Portuguese invaded us in 1500. But now, you know, there's proper investigations about it and people are going to jail. Indeed. So.
Well, that's Exame and Estoé and Veia Sao Paulo. Veia Sao Paulo being obviously the pick of them because that's the one with the priest dressed as Elvis on the cover. Fernando, thank you as ever for joining us. That's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we will be talking soap and censorship in Turkey.
It's the art of publishing with skates on. Here it comes, Monocle Alpino. Here's what some of our Wrapped Up for the Elements editors have for you this winter.
In the affairs section, we take to the slopes with a Swiss scientist trying to predict when avalanches strike.
In the business section, we visit Slovenia to see how one ski company has been making its precious pieces since 1945.
In culture, we head to the Arctic Circle to find out how Norwegians do music festivals. Needless to say, they do them cooler than most.
Monocle Alpino is on newsstands now. For more information and Monocle subscriptions, head to monocle.com.
For Monocle's 2014 Travel Top 50, our correspondents have journeyed far and wide by road, rail and sea to compile the best ways to travel and what to do when you arrive.
Hotelier André Bellage chose our home turf of Marylebone for his first hotel venture outside the US. Despite Bellage's reputation for placemaking, few could have predicted the success of the Chiltern Firehouse, which has since become the go-to haunt for after-work drinks and client schmoozing dinners.
Buckle up and join us for our annual rundown, Monocle's 2014 Travel Top 50, now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House, 1841 here in London. Now, when Turkish police raided the offices of the country's leading newspapers last Sunday, they were looking for more than just journalists and editors and, you know, among other usual troublemakers. Among the 30 people apprehended by police for alleged involvement in a plotted coup to overthrow the Turkish government were a number of soap opera producers and directors, obviously, including the head of the media group that makes this.
Yeni projemizin adı... tahşiye olacaktır.
Efendim özür dilerim ama bu nasıl bir eylem planı ilk defa duyuyoruz.
Onları tekrar zor durumda bırakacak yeni bir iltica dalgasıdır.
Now, that obvious anti-establishment propaganda is from only Turkey on the Samanyolo channel. The country's soap operas have been one of Turkey's leading exports in recent years. But how deeply connected are they, if indeed at all, with the murky politics at the centre of Turkey's ongoing corruption probe? I'm joined now by our Istanbul bureau chief, Joseph Dana. Joseph, President Erdogan has been behaving for some time now in an increasingly, to put it charitably, sultan-like fashion, sultanate fashion. He's not a man who takes kindly to criticism, this we know. Rounding up the producers of soap operas, is this as mad as it sounds?
Yes.
Well, Joseph, thanks for joining us. Moving swiftly along. No, really, what is this? This is bizarre.
So effectively, what we have here is that this is, you know, Turkish soap operas are a very, very big deal in Turkey and abroad. I mean, these are exported to more than 70 countries around the world. The revenue stream is about $130 million per year. And so they carry a lot of weight. And anything that carries weight in the media in Turkey has, you know, incredible politics associated to it. Now, the people that were apprehended in this probe work for a channel that is funded by Fethullah Gulen, who's the Muslim cleric living in self-imposed exile in the United States.
And who is very much President Erdogan's chief bogeyman.
Effectively.
Yeah. But
more than a bogeyman. I mean, he's basically at the heart of this corruption probe. His people loyal to him are releasing a lot of information about the president and his business dealings and whatnot. And so the group that was really at the heart of this whole soap opera business was producing this Tek Turkiye, which is the clip we heard from just now. And the reason why they were taken in, according to the Turkish government, is that in this kind of over-the-top soap opera, one of the groups that is really the main rival of the Gulenists in Turkey is portrayed as a terrorist organization. And there's some other, let's call them, or at least Erdogan calls them, sacrilegious elements to the actual product that they are broadcasting. And so this was enough for them to be taken in as part of this this new raid. And they were, most of them were let out after interrogation on Sunday night. So they're not actually imprisoned, but it demonstrates that this net is being widened, as it were, because at its core, these are people that are making fiction. I mean, this is not real. These are soap operas.
This crackdown in general, though, not just on the soap opera, but on everything else that Erdogan is cracking down on, is this just an expression of, I mean, is he just basically in the grips of some sort of quite severe flight of paranoia, or is there an audience he's playing to with this?
I would say it's both. I don't know. There's definitely an audience that he's playing to. He has a very, very deep base in the kind of Anatolian heartland of support that that believe that the Turkish government is under attack by the Gulenists. And there is a certain amount of weight to that. There was a corruption probe that was launched a year ago exactly that was designed to basically bring down the Turkish government. Now, Erdogan opening this incredibly large net is such a verbose and over-the-top reaction to it that it requires some treatment. You know, we have to keep in mind that last week, a couple of pro-government newspapers in Turkey released statements against Orhan Pamuk, the Turkish Nobel Prize winning writer, and Elif Shafik, who is based in London, saying that they were part of the, quote, international literature lobby that is designed to attack the Turkish government. So it's a slippery slope.
Reminds me, my subscription's overdue, the international literature lobby. I got my membership reminder last week. Yours is probably still in the post. But this is crazy talk.
Of course it's crazy talk. The question is what's going to be the reaction, right? What is the cost for this kind of craziness? Is the EU going to step up? You know, there was some very strong language from the European Union after this last raid, saying that, you know, this is a very serious endeavor that they're embarking on and that it could hurt the ascension process. So is Erdogan willing to risk Turkey's position with the West in order to, you know, interrogate and possibly put in jail the producers of soap operas in Turkey? I mean, that is what we're dealing with.
You live in Istanbul. You work in our Istanbul bureau. In Istanbul, as people who know it well know, it's one of the world's great cultural hubs. It's a crossing point for ideas and arts, and has been for centuries. How is this kind of this onslaught against expression by Erdogan playing in Istanbul, which I realize is not necessarily his heartland?
Well, there's many parts of Istanbul that are his heartland. You know, in the center,
it's a big city.
Yeah, in the center, in the European side, people are very dismayed about what's going on, and these are the exact same people that were out on the streets a year ago in the Gezi Park protests protesting Erdogan. And so they're angry. This is fueling their anger, but there's no real concrete political opposition that they can funnel that anger into. But if you go into the periphery of Istanbul, where, you know, even ISIS militants are hanging out, you will find people that don't necessarily have a problem with Erdogan's, kind of behavior. And so it's a very big city. It's a very big country. But so far, like I said, there's been no cost for this kind of really over-the-top, almost reckless authoritarianism that Erdogan is propagating.
I mean, do you get any sense at all that there is a point at which he will push his luck too far, or that he's even anywhere near such a point?
I was thinking that earlier this summer, and because of the relationship with the West specifically, there was a lot of fallout with the United States over how to combat ISIS in Syria and whatnot. And then Erdogan quite deftly, you know, kind of threw his lot in with Putin. You know, the South Stream oil pipeline was canceled. The oil revenues are going to start flowing through Turkey effectively. And so it looks like he's positioning himself with new allies that will allow him to continue this type of rule. And so he's very serious. He's doubling down about rooting out what he calls these coup agitators, and he's going to attack everyone, including soap operas.
First they came for the soap operas, etc. Joseph Dana from Monocle's Istanbul Bureau, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Hey. heading towards the end of today's show now, coming up for 1849 here in London, which means it's time for our daily arts review. And today we're turning to music. The New York-based DJ producer, now educator, the appropriately named as it turned out, Young Guru, was passing through London last week. It's possible you may have seen him on stage with Jay-Z as his full-time tour DJ. Young Guru sat down with Monocle's Paul Noble to discuss his musical roots and whether hip-hop is yet properly respected as a mature art form.
Young Guru, welcome into the Monocle Studios.
Thank you.
This is a flying visit to Europe. What brings you here this time?
Yeah, I'm coming in to do some master classes and just teach a little bit. I love London, and I haven't made it back as much as I normally have in the past couple of years. So I'm real happy to be back and conducting some master classes.
So let's talk about your teaching, because obviously you've made your name as a DJ and producer, but you've now moved into passing it on to the next generation.
Yeah, I just feel like engineering is something that, you know, is like a black science that was sort of passed down in the studio from person to person. Like, I got a lot of stuff from Tony Maserati, great engineer. So this is what I'm trying to do, is give people the stuff that's beyond book knowledge. And with me now becoming an associate professor at USC, education is something that I'm really big on, in studying and figuring out teaching as much as anything else.
And do you think, particularly in hip-hop, people don't really respect the craft and how to get a really good hip-hop mix which works on the radio and
absolutely
in the clubs?
Absolutely. It's one of the younger genres, you know what I mean? It's younger than jazz. It's younger than rock. It's younger than, you know, the rest of the genres. So that's our purpose now. Sort of the older hip-hoppers should be documenting things, writing things down, doing books, you know, all of these things. You can go pick up a million books on jazz music, from technical aspects to the history of the people that did it, you know, all the way to rock and roll. We have all of the, you know, backstories, but we also have the Beatles Red Book, you know, which is strictly about, you know, how did we do this? So, you know, creating those things for hip hop.
Okay, you've brought four tracks in with you today. Let's start digging into them and hearing a bit of work, some of the work you've mm-hmm. produced yourself and other people's who you're digging. So where do you want to start?
You pick.
Okay. Yeah. I am going to go for Big Ramo and Ninth, because I've never heard of them.
Big Ramo is one of the guys that is down with Ninth Wonder. Ninth Wonder is a real good personal friend of mine. I love what he's doing in carrying the underground tradition. But Big Ramo is someone who, when I get in the room with all the people that Ninth has signed, it's sort of like the planets. We sort of gravitate towards each other. And this is a song that I produced for him on his last album. And it's one of the works that went under the radar, but I absolutely love it. Hickey's on your chest, another 5 minutes, I'ma put you to bed. I'm just a young fly nigga, love getting it in. If you with it, then I'm ready. Shout it, get in the whip, and we can smoke a little sticky, drink a little tipsy. Yak in the back, latex got a 12 pack, brain in the charger. You're laying with the stars, hoping it never end when you're playing with the balls. Now he sleep on the couch while you leaving the house with an overnight bag.
Shame to cut it off. Absolutely lovely flow and lovely production on that.
I appreciate that, man. Yeah, it was one of the joints that we knocked out when I was in North Carolina. It's featuring Colin Monroe, and it's really interesting pitch variations on the way we did the hook. But Ramo is one of those guys I just gravitate towards. I really love him.
So yeah. I have to ask, it's a really very soulful sound. We were talking just before we got in the studio about sort of reconnecting with what made you passionate about music in the first place in an era of streaming music, and it's easy just to grab songs out of fresh air now.
I just like staying sharp, you know. Anybody can grab a laptop and become sort of a DJ, and DJs today nowadays are sort of like the celebrity of the DJ is almost as big as the skill. When, you know, when I was coming up, it was absolutely all about skill. But there's things that you can do. You know, there's a party that goes on in New York called Mobile Mondays, all 45 party, you know, all vinyl, all 45. And it's really that statement. It's really to get us away from the laptops, to get us back into digging, discovering music, you know, new things. It's that type of audience that likes to hear stuff that they've never heard before. Also, if you go for about 3 or 4 weeks, you know, then you get educated to the fact that the audience knows a lot of music. So you can't just come in there and play like the normal, regular, just pop records. You have to sort of dig and understand that audience, but they're so receptive to anything that's good. It's just one of those rooms where it's like either it's good or it's not. So if it's good music, they'll respond, and I don't care what genre you're playing, you know, and it's that thing that has sort of gotten my love back for just discovering new music.
And how do you, as someone who's sort of seen all the changing faces of nightlife in New York, how do you sort of rate the state of New York club life at the moment?
What killed New York club life is the bottle service and the table service. It's like now, you know, and I'm not knocking a new generation. I'm 40 years old, you know. So when I was 18 and 19 and 20 years old, yeah, I wanted to go to the club and I wanted to drink. But there was a lot more dancing that went on. I guess I was more concerned with girls than I was with other guys looking at how many bottles I had on my table, you know. And that's what New York nightlife has sort of become. It's become, let me buy a bunch of bottles and stand at this table so everyone else can see that I bought a lot of bottles, instead of like enjoying the music and dancing and having a great time. But there is still, you know, it's New York City. So that's just the pop end of it, or what I consider the pop end of it. There's still so much to do in New York, you know, on any given day. You know, there's so much that's culturally, you know, something that's interesting. So New York is a very interesting place.
Let's move on to your next track. It's yeah. Success, Jay-Z featuring Nas.
Let that bitch breathe. I'm way too important to be talking about extorting. Asking me for a Porsche is like asking for a coffin. Broad daylight, I off your on switch. You're not too bright, good night, long kiss. Bye-bye, my reply, blah, blah. Blast burner and pass burner to ta-ta. Finish my breakfast, why? I got an appetite for destruction.
So just a touch of Success, that's Jay-Z featuring Nas, engineered by Young Guru, my studio guest.
I absolutely love that record.
And for those that don't know, you are Jay-Z's DJ and have been working with him since 1999.
I started engineering for him in 99. In 2010 was when I started going on the road for him.
So give us an idea of what it's like traveling around with the king of hip-hop.
I actually don't travel with him. I opted to travel with the band.
Okay.
Just because I like to do regular stuff, you know.
Right.
So I like to go places and absorb the culture and all those other things. So when, you know, I'd like to travel with the band. That was my option, and I decided to go with the B team just because I wanted to do after parties and I wanted to walk around places and
right.
not have to leave and get in a plane right after the shows and things like that. So it's much easier doing that with the band.
Nice.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Doom, the mysterious man of hip-hop. We're going to end
on... I love him.
We're going to end on one of his tracks.
Yes. This next track is exactly the way that Doom works. I sent his hype man, as a great friend of mine from college, and I, as usual, send him a bunch of beats and then you never hear anything back. And then one day, just out of the blue, probably about a year and a half after I sent him this track, my friend calls me back and he's like, hey, remember that track you sent Doom? He did it. You know, so that's how I found out about this Doom record. It's actually a remix to one of the Doom Slayer joints that he did, but it was just finally, I have production with MF Doom.
Well, Young Guru, thanks for dropping by the Monocle Studios on your whirlwind European tour.
Thank you so much.
In Lachesh, planetary kin, red overtone dragon, make your barathery spin. In the flesh with a band of merry men, innocent civilians, Harry carry over yen. Is it the end or for pretend? I can neither condemn nor defend. Cast us more pussy than a sanitary napkin bin. Villain ran a scam on his imaginary rapping friend. Again, shame on us. We're in the same game. Put the blame on Gus.
It's Paul Noble speaking to Young Guru, and that's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks to our earlier special guests, Tim Marshall and James Boyes. Today's show was produced by Alice Block, research by David Pleasant and Jonathan Bartlett. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. Next up, after the headlines, it's Section D. At 2200, I'm back with Ted Kravitz for the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.